KXNO, 1230 AM, W255DN, Wausau. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
CBS News Brief. Sources tell CBS News President Trump is considering U.S. attacks on nuclear sites in Iran. From the White House, CBS's Linda Kenyon.
Some of the top military brass and Middle East envoy Steve Witkoff were among those who emerged from the Situation Room after roughly an hour and 20 minutes. But reports indicated they were not in full agreement.
A three-judge appeals court panel today heard arguments in a lawsuit challenging the president's authority to federalize some members of the California National Guard and send them to Los Angeles. Loyola Law School professor Lori Levinson.
It did look like all of them were inclined to give a great deal, if not unfettered deference, to President Trump.
The case will likely be appealed to the Supreme Court. Retail sales dropped sharply in May, says CBS News business analyst Jill Schlesinger.
This is one of the few instances in hard data that we are seeing feelings of uneasiness translate into a change of action.
CBS News Brief. I'm Christopher Cruz.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
Another win for the Thunder. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports, basketball, NBA Finals. The Oklahoma City Thunder, with a victory at home last night, 120-109 over the Indiana Pacers. OKC's Jalen Williams, with a playoff career-high 40 points, was asked how were the Thunder defensively able to hold off the Pacers this time in the fourth quarter.
Everybody's just really aggressive. Everybody takes pride in it. And when you have five guys on the floor that are taking pride in their matchup, it makes your defense very special. So we're all willing to cover for each other and just make the right reads defensively. And when we mess up, we don't stop.
Game six is Thursday night. OKC up 3-2. Baseball tonight, the Brewers against the first-place Cubs in Chicago. Milwaukee's been on a roll since they swept the Phillies at Citizens Bank Park. Trevor McGill.
I mean, I feel like the team's been doing it for a couple of weeks now, ever since that Phillies, you know, kind of turnaround series. You know, we're stringing some wins together.
That's Brewers pitcher Trevor McGill with Sports on Mike Clemens.
I love playing sports, especially for my school. And that's because school sports are special. It's where it's safe to fail. It's where we're taught resilience. Where our fear becomes confidence. It's where we learn to get back up after every fall. School sports are where 7.8 million students go from I can't to I can.
This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
This is Bull Falls Radio, WXCO.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Going to spend time with a couple of labor leaders. Talking about the weekend's events, the No Kings rallies, labor's involvement in defending democracy. Because understand, labor unions have long played a pivotal role in defending our democracy, empowering working people to demand accountability, not just from their employers, but from their legislators, from their government. By organizing collectively, what we have seen is unions not only fight for better wages, hours, and conditions, they also fight to expand political participation, challenge corporate power, advance civil rights, stand up in the face of evil, be on the right side of history. You go back to the 1930s, it was labor. It was working people during the heart of the Depression who stood up and fought for an economy that included people. Working people. Unions pushed back against the massive economic inequality and the widespread unemployment. It was labor who fought the Gilded Age. The labor movement's growing strength, the people in the streets, that's what forced Franklin Delano Roosevelt to pass a pro-worker legislation. The Wagner Act in 1935, which we talk about all the time, National Labor Relations Act, legalized workers' ability to unionize, to strike, to collectively bargain, all things that are under attack. And in turn, organized labor pushed for Social Security, minimum wage, unemployment insurance, expanded the democratic economy. What good is an economy if it doesn't support a working class? And what happened is by mobilizing these millions of workers, it gave working people the ability to share in the American dream, create the American dream. It gave working class Americans a voice in national policy and really helped legitimize the government as a force for good, not just an arm of the wealthy and powerful, which sadly, this is kind of where we are now. You fast forward into the 50s and 60s, and look, labor was right there, front and center, fighting for civil rights. Many of the unions that affiliated with the AFL-CIO were active participants in the civil rights movement, linking labor rights with racial justice and voting rights. Union leaders like A. Philip Randolph, key. The 1963 March on Washington, kind of a big freaking deal and a turning point. And look, labor provided the financial backing, which again is why you see Republicans going after labor, because labor has been on the right side of history time and time again, not just with boots on the ground and people walking shoulder to shoulder, but funding those things, funding legal challenges, funding the ability to stand up in the face of evil. Unions demanded political accountability for segregation and voter suppression. And what did they get? Paved the way for the Voting Rights Act. Paved the right for the Civil Rights Act of 64. And in the 80s, you know, while Reagan was you know, spending money like a drunken sailor, it was the labor movement who funded the Solidarity movement in Poland that brought down the Soviet Union. And really, you know, Lech Walesa, who we had talked about recently, and the people who engaged in the Solidarity movement, that was the center of resistance against authoritarianism. And for the first time in a Soviet bloc country, you had an independent union demanding things like free speech, political reforms of people being able to vote, democratic elections. You had mass mobilizations that forced the government to negotiate, ultimately, like I said, leading to the fall of communism. This was a labor-led movement. And what it was able to do is really just spark incredible change across Eastern Europe. And yet, we don't learn that history. You know, you go back to the New Deal, which created, and you know, I talk about this often because it's so important. Those New Deal policies that working people who were organizing in the tens and twenties were able to get through in the thirties, built the most prosperous working class in the history of humanity. Why? Not because Roosevelt cared about working people, but because working people pushed Roosevelt in that direction. You want the vote? You got to do something. Something maybe we should be thinking about how we reclaim. And it was because of these people in the streets. You know, there's the famous story of, you know, someone coming to Roosevelt saying, hey, we want you to do this. And him going, no, you go out there and you make me do it. Get people in the street. Get people active. Organize. Make me do it. And ultimately what happened? Out of that administration, you fundamentally reshaped this country. And capitalism along with it, saved capitalism from eating itself. You know, during the Great Depression, you had widespread unemployment, economic collapse, growing unrest. And labor unions were right there on the front lines, organizing workers, like we're seeing today. Forcing recognition of workers' rights in the 30s was important. That key recognition across auto, steel, textiles, mining. Exposing the limits of laissez-faire capitalism and making government intervene. This is what Roosevelt did. Roosevelt supported the NIRA, the National Industrial Recovery Act, which included, you know, some guarantees of workers' rights. It's that first push. And employers, well, they ignored the rights. And you had strikes. You had general strikes in San Francisco and Minneapolis, the Teamsters strike in Minneapolis. You had strikes in Toledo. These strikes pushed for what I argue was a peace treaty. The Wagner Act, the National Labor Relations Act, which right now what you have a Republican Party hell-bent on destroying. So when you see workers out in the streets by the millions, understand that those are working people. And that in 1933, there were 3 million union members. By 1941, you had over 8 million people joining unions. This is what the wealth class of this country fears like none other. Because if you feel emboldened in the workplace, you're going to feel emboldened in your political space. And out of the New Deal, like I said, Social Security, unemployment, you know, all kinds of public works programs, WPA, CCC, the Fair Labor Standard Acts, got rid of child labor, banned child labor, brought us a federal minimum wage, overtime rules. Things that you got to ask yourself today, could we win? Could we get any of that stuff? I'm not so certain. So for me, the reality is seeing these people out in the streets over the weekend gives me great hope that tomorrow we build a future for our children and for our grandchildren, that they look back and go, in the moment, they were right. They fought for something. They won something. And I hope my great-great-grandchildren take it for granted, as we have. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I'm sure everyone saw the video that went around of the reporter, I think she was Australian, who, you know, doing the, you know, the person on the street, you know, looking at, you know, with the cops behind him. All of a sudden, she gets shot in the leg or in the back. And, you know, the cameraman just catches the policeman. All the other cops are looking the other way. This one guy, I got to tell you, I don't see any way that wasn't on purpose. And that's why when I saw CWA's President Claude Cummings Jr. Put out a post on June 12th saying, hey, members of our union and other journalists have been targeted by law enforcement with less lethal rounds and tear gas and detained while covering the protests in Los Angeles. He writes, these journalists are doing important work to keep the public informed. This violent intimidation is unacceptable and threatens one of our most fundamental rights as Americans, the right to a free press. He goes on to say, attempts to dodge accountability and evade responsibility put all of us in danger. He says, I'm grateful to the journalists and other media workers who put themselves in harm's way to bring us the news. The leaders of law enforcement agencies must take steps to protect their safety and investigate any actions that interfere with their ability to do their jobs. And I agree. I may have been even a little bit stronger in this because it is the one profession that is constitutionally protected. And here to share some thoughts on what's going on the ground and you know, maybe what we should all be demanding. I've asked John Schlois to come talk with us. John's the president of the News Guild, also a vice president at CWA. John, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Rick.
So I'm sure you saw that video, and there are others out there of journalists, of reporters, of citizens journalists being attacked, their equipment broken. You know, it seems like there's a policy of targeting some of this, but that's just me looking at it from the outside. I want to get your thoughts.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that it looks really clear, like targeting by the police at all levels, whether it's the Los Angeles Police Department, it's the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, whether it's California Highway Patrol or federal agencies such as DHS. We've seen, working with like the Los Angeles Press Club, we've seen at least 36 journalists or media workers hit or impacted by these less than lethal munitions. And it's clear that they're members of the media. They've got a big camera. They've got press on a helmet. They have a press badge. And, you know, police can't just shoot them with tear gas, rubber bullets or pepper ball bullets. We have a lot of members who have been injured by covering these protests, and they have a constitutional right. As you said, the First Amendment protects the right of journalists to be able to cover in the public space what law enforcement is doing at these protests. And California law even goes further in protecting them. So it's a complete overreach, and it's really terrible behavior by law enforcement at all levels.
And what's interesting is, you know, immediately, because I had, you know, some people reach out to me and go, you know, those are union members getting shot by union members. And this is one of those weird kind of Jay Gould moments where I can easily pay half the working class to murder the other half, or in this case, shoot them with rubber bullets or tear gas.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's totally likely. We had a similar situation happen a few years ago in the aftermath of the murder of George Floyd at the hands of police in Minnesota. Police in Minnesota then violently cracked down on protesters and attacked journalists there too. We ended up actually joining the ACLU in Minnesota and sued several different layers of the police department, whether it was the Hennepin County Sheriff, it was the Minneapolis Police Department, and the Minnesota State Patrol. We also sued directly the leader of the police union because he was behind efforts, according to our filings and our research, he was behind efforts to actively cause the police and train police officers to target members of the media.
That, I gotta tell you, that's frightening to me because look, you know, at the end of the day, their job is to serve, protect and serve everyone, even the people who are protesting. And again, and this is where my red hat friends who I know have carried that little pocket constitution around, I wish they would crack it open. But you know, that's a right. It is a fundamental right. It is the bedrock of this wonderful experiment of self-governance to redress our grievances, to look to government and have our voices heard. So to have an arm of our government crack down and do the things that we've seen, I find distressing at best, disheartening, and, well, angering.
Yeah. I mean, so the First Amendment is clear. I mean, this, you know, there's five freedoms in the First Amendment. One is the freedom of the press. The other is the freedom to peacefully assemble. But in the First Amendment, it's clear, and there's a Supreme Court case on this, that journalists have the right to photograph and record matters of public interest. I would say a massive protest in Los Angeles and a police response is a matter of public interest, and they can't be targeted for simply doing their jobs. I mean, you know, our jobs as journalists is to seek truth and report it. So when we're out there on the streets, law enforcement can say, hey, can you move over here? Because we're going to go in this direction, or you're in the way, or if there's, you know, journalists impeding, they have the right to say, you can't impede us doing our jobs. That's all fair game. But you cannot you cannot shoot a journalist in the head with a rubber bullet, which is what we have in multiple instances here.
Now, I've had a number of people push back and say, well, you know, they weren't real journalists, John. They were just people looking for trouble. Is there a demarcation of a real journalist or not?
Yeah, I mean, go back to the founding principles of this country, right? The idea that the government has a say in who is a real journalist or not is unconstitutional. It is not allowed. And that's actually, I think, a beauty of American democracy is that anyone can be a journalist. There's no licensing program. So In this situation, which is in most situations, we had this in Minnesota, we've seen it now here in Los Angeles, you've got a mixture of folks who work full-time at the Los Angeles Times, at the Southern California News Group, at the New York Times, at this Australian broadcaster, at Cal Matters. Those are all employers, and we represent workers and journalists at all of those employers who have been impacted. But you also have freelancers here. And the freelancers are sometimes the most at risk here because they don't have an employer who's providing them a helmet or a vest to not get hit, or you know, goggles or a mask if there's tear gas. So the freelance journalists end up actually piping a lot of the video and a lot of the photos into a lot of these other bigger outlets who don't have someone on the ground. So it's a mixture of folks, and it's not for anyone to decide who isn't as a journalist. But if you are looking at the situation and you've got someone with a camera, a professional camera, got someone with a notepad, got someone with a camera out, got someone that says press on their helmet or a badge, or you know, a press badge issued potentially by local law enforcement, those folks are members of the media regardless. And you just got to respect them. You got to respect them based on the fact that they are doing the job of reporting out what's going on. Again, journalists can't impede police officers, but you do have a right to report on.
You hit something there that I'm curious about, because, you know, is there a way to, you know, to mark them as journalists? Because I don't know that I'm comfortable with that, but I'm curious where your thought on your statement was that, you know, they went to the police, they got credentials. Are we in favor of credentialing reporters and you know, saying that these are the protected? Because, you know, I've also had it thrown back, well, you know, not everyone's a journalist. I'm like, well, maybe everyone is. In this day and age, everyone's got a cell phone. Everybody's recording something. The internet is there. There are blogs everywhere. I'm curious your thoughts. If you think there's a line where there should be or not.
Yeah, I mean, so I actually am really against the idea of credentialing journalists. I think that that's a really bad role to play. But some law enforcement agencies do this. When we were suing the Minnesota State Patrol, they actually were trying to get us to agree in part of our settlement discussions for some credentialing process. And I was really against it because I don't want a government agency to decide who is and isn't a journalist. But like you say, anyone can be a journalist. I mean, our highest award in the industry is the Pulitzer Prizes. And a young girl in Minnesota who recorded the video in the final moments of George Floyd's life, she was given the Pulitzer Prize for her work, pulling out her phone and recording a video that changed America.
So as we've been seeing the stuff going on in Los Angeles, we saw, you know, the big dictator parade on Saturday. We saw the No Kings rallies. We're seeing a lot of activity. There is a lot of people getting into the streets. So it's my view that we're going to see a lot more tension. What do you think is a direction forward that, you know, maybe law enforcement could pursue, that maybe legislators could pursue, and then maybe we citizens should be pursuing to ensure that we do get the information we need, we do protect the people who are bringing it to us, and we do honor what is our constitutional values?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really terrifying situation right now where you have more violence escalating. And we saw, you know, the assassinations happen just in Minnesota recently. And I don't think violence is the answer from any direction. And I don't like it, especially when it's coming from the government. And I think big displays of military power and bringing weapons of war onto the streets of our cities and communities in America is not the answer. So what can folks do? If you're a law enforcement agency, you gotta respect the rights of journalists and peaceful protesters and not interfere with them. There will be a number of cases that come out of this, a number of lawsuits that come out of this. They haven't seen them yet, but they will be filed, just as we saw in Minnesota, and we'll be part of those efforts if necessary. But, you know, there's a huge cost to violating the law, you know, in terms of monetary costs, but also in terms of people losing their jobs in law enforcement agencies and higher ups, people having to do different training. We won that out of the Minnesota case, is actually having members of the Minnesota State Patrol have to do training to make sure that they weren't violating the rights of journalists and media workers. So, you know, if you're law enforcement, follow the law and respect the rights of working journalists. You're out there just trying to provide a public service similar to police officials, is to actually inform the public here. So don't interfere with them. Legislators can increase the rights of journalists. Several states have taken actions to do that. In California, you know, it makes it a violation of the state's penal code to block off areas from journalists and prevent them from being able to report inside, like, you know, beyond the police tape. You also can't search and seize equipment from journalists. So it was an expansion in California law that expanded beyond the First and the Fourth Amendments from the Constitution. I think so there's good benefit in there to expand protections for journalists. And finally, if you're just a regular American, a thing you can do is just subscribe to these publications, right? If you're wanting to follow the news there, subscribe to the Los Angeles Times, subscribe to the Southern California News Group. And remember that the folks who are actually bringing you the news from the streets in a lot of these situations are working people who are not necessarily paid a lot of money. And it's extremely dangerous to be out there when tear gas is flying, when pepper bullets are flying and rubber bullets are hitting people in the head. I mean, it is dangerous work and it costs money to provide it.
Yeah. And the concern for me is outside of law enforcement, the people who are supposed to protect us. I think we're moving towards a period, unfortunately, that is going to be very violent, that you're going to see people targeting journalists, targeting politicians, much like we saw in Minnesota. My concern is this gets worse, that nothing seems to just end with a one-off. It seems like we build on, and there are multiples, and I hope I'm wrong. But I fear this is where we end up, where journalists and more politicians are being targeted.
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, if you really scoot back in the long frame of history, if we go back 100, 150 years, we're actually in a really low violent state of humanity. maybe I'm a little bit bonkers to think back that far, but you know, we built our society based on, you know, a ton of violence just 100 years ago. To one that's less violent now, and it's so much better to not have each other kill each other. It's also important for politicians from every spectrum to make sure that they are really pushing against violence and calling it out and condemning it directly. I think that's also really important. But you're right, it's a concerning trend in this moment, and I hope it ends. But you know, journalists are going to continue to do their jobs. They've done them in dangerous war zones out all across the globe. So we'll continue to do our jobs to report the news.
Good. Last line of questioning I've got for you, because you know, look, over the weekend we. Whether you believe that Saturday's parade was a dictator parade, or if you believe Trump is moving the country in that direction, I do believe we're moving in an authoritarian direction. I see labor under attack at every opportunity. What's labor's role in defending our Constitution, our democracy, our economy from what's coming? And what are you guys doing to kind of pick that role up and move it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a core principle. I mean, we're not going to have a good democracy if we don't have a strong labor movement. And we've seen the downward trend of fewer and fewer people being part of the labor movement, being represented by unions. So I think the first thing that every union needs to do is organize. And if you've got leaders at the top of these unions who are not effectively organized, you got to kick them out. Like, they need to go, because we need to have a plan that actually focuses on organizing tens and hundreds of millions of workers across this country. That's got to be the end all. And every single union should be developing a strategic plan to organize people in their industry. I think once you organize workers and you get them in the struggle where they understand that they have a benefit in the collective, that it actually serves their interests to support their colleagues' interests, that starts to change the dynamics of how our entire society operates, because it makes it more about a collective and less about an individual. And I worry that, like, too many politicians, particularly on the right, are actively trying to divide us by race, divide us by sex, divide us by class. And we need to bring people together at this moment. And when you start to do that and you organize people in labor movement, that actually builds a fighting resistance.
And that's why I thought the rally over the weekend, the No Kings rally, was a success. You brought a large number of people out in the streets, many probably for the first time in their lives. We began, I think, the process of understanding and rediscovering what solidarity is. I see very positive things that come out of this going forward. And again, I hope labor at the front of it does do what they do and organize folks to continue that fight forward.
Yeah, we actually had two leaders speak at two different No Kings rallies. We had Susan DiCarava, our president of the News Guild of New York, speak at the one in New York City at the front of it, which she is an amazing leader, building up the News Guild of New York into a fighting, aggressive local union, part of our union. And we also had a striker, actually, at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. We've been on strike there for 32 months, and Natalie Duliba spoke at the No Kings rally there in Pittsburgh. So, you know, being there and making sure it was centered on working class folks that are under attack, I think is key.
We got a lot of work to do, John, but I appreciate the thoughts. Keep up the great work, and I look forward to talking to you again.
Thanks so much for having me, Rick.
John Schlois, president of the News Guild, also vice president over at CWA. You want to check out their work, cwa/union.org. We'll get links out on social media. I can take a look at that. I want to hear your thoughts. Are you concerned if you get out to these rallies? Are you concerned for our journalists? I want to hear it. Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back.
You're listening to Bull Falls Radio, WXCO. Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Mostly cloudy with a few showers and thunderstorms tonight and lows in the mid-60s. Cloudy with scattered showers and thunderstorms for tomorrow, highs 70 to 75. More sunshine for Thursday, warm and muggy with a few showers and thunderstorms by Thursday night. Highs near 80. It's 71 right now.
Nightlight with Pete Schwalbe.
Todd Michaels joins us now.
I have to give a shout out to Oshkosh. It's a very underrated city.
There was also a restaurant there I really liked. I don't think it's there anymore.
Yeah, Vitaly's was great. I may have gone to like a prom dinner there or something like that back in my day too, Pete.
A little calzone before you tear it up in the dance floor.
Man, there's nothing better than wearing a tuxedo and a little calzone in your cummerbund.
Nightlight with Pete Schwalbe. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So over the weekend, as everyone I'm sure saw, you had the incredible turnout across the country of working people taking to the streets, defending democracy, standing up for democratic American values, the Constitution, all of that. A lot of signs, a lot of memes, liked a lot of the memes. And at the front of most of these marches, these rallies, were my labor friends. One of those guys out in the streets on this weekend, No Kings Rally weekend, my friend Josh Zivilich. He's the president and principal officer at Teamsters Local 769 down in Southern Florida. Josh, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me, Rick. I'm happy to join you.
So let's start with, you know, why were you out over the weekend? What drew you to the street with a couple million people across the country?
I think it was just I'm outraged, really. You know, I'm outraged by many of the things that are going on with this administration towards organized labor, and then, you know, the agencies that back organized labor and the agencies that back working Americans. I think that's a real problem, and it's going to lead to long-term problems for the American workforce, both unionized and not unionized. And I felt I had to go out there and speak our piece and be a part of the protests, you know, to the Trump administration and some of the damage that they're doing.
You know, as a labor leader, how do you see organized labor's role in defending democratic institutions, democratic values, you know, democracy as a whole? How do you see organized labor in all of that?
Well, I think that organized labor plays a key role in that. Our institution, I mean, you know, you're a Teamster, I'm a Teamster. You know, we have democratic institutions to have local union elections, to have elections in our international union. It's a check and balance, right? It's to make sure that, you know, you have a you know, qualified leaders and hold them to account. And certainly that's what And because we operate in that type of a system, right, all the while trying our best to represent our members and negotiate good contracts, I think it gives us a very important role as organized labor to advocate for democratic ideals, right, to advocate for free elections. You know, Mr. Trump, you know, talking about a third term, even joking about it, that's preposterous, right? I mean, that's just something that we can't allow for, no matter whether you supported him or not. I think that most everybody realizes that that's, you know,
that's outside of bounds.
What he said he was going to,
that's out of bounds. But you know, I think what you're talking about is, you know, empowerment. One of the things I talk about that our union has done for me has given me that sense of being empowered, not just in the workplace, but in society as a whole. And I look at this No Kings rally that drew huge crowds across the country. And I got to ask, you know, do you see a connection between worker power and political accountability? Do you see a moment where empowered workers are demanding, feeling empowered in the political space to demand that accountability?
I would certainly hope so, right? I mean, at the rally that I was out in Miami, there was a gentleman that I saw. I mean, the hotel workers had a strong presence out there, and the AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees.
Well, those make perfect sense because they're both front and center targets on their back by this administration. Hospitality workers and government workers, those are Trump's targets.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, look, the TSA, I mean, just with what an executive order, I believe, is how Mr. Trump did away with the TSA union. I know that they're in a legal battle over that right now. But just with the stroke of a pen, and AFGE as well. I mean, they've got under the guise of Homeland Security that we can't have federal employees that are organized, essentially just doing away with their union. It's absurd. Of course, the hotel workers, you know, they're largely an immigrant membership, right? And it was good to see them out there. It was good to see their president was out there. She's a friend. We worked together on numerous things trying to advance the agenda of working folks in South Florida, and a lot of labor presence out there. And I think that bodes well for the future, and to hold some of these anti-union you know, representatives, whether they're senators, congressional reps, or the president, accountable.
Yeah. No, I mean, you've got to look at what happened over the weekend as just an amazing opportunity to do some more organizing. I mean, this is what you guys live for. And I guess the question that, you know, I got to ask is, you know, why is it important for unions to be involved in fights beyond the workplace? Things like this, you know, voting rights, you know, resisting authoritarianism. And I guess the other side of that is, how do you then respond to people who say, you know what, you should just stay in your lane. You're a labor union. That's what you should stick to. Don't engage in that political stuff.
Well, you know, I'm not going to bury my head in the sand. we just can't do that as an organization. There's a friend of mine who's a labor leader in a different part of the country who I'm not going to name him. But I saw him essentially in social media this weekend attacking protesters, you know, making fun of them and jeering at them and whatnot. And I get the peaceful protest versus the guys that are trying to incite violence and things of that nature. What I saw in Miami was completely peaceful, right? There was a lot of happiness from people, I think, that were connecting in their disgust with what's going on. But to stay in your lane, guess what? These anti-protest legislation that got passed in Florida, by the way, we have some very strict anti-protest legislation, including a governor that, you know, essentially indicated that, you know, folks could run over protesters. Well, I'll remind that unnamed labor leader in another part of the country, guess what? When we've got a strike going on, right, that's going to affect us. When they're limiting your right to assemble, free speech, picket lines, and as we know, I mean, Rick, you're out of the trucking sector. When you when you're walking on a picket line and you're at a terminal, a freight terminal, or at a delivery service, there's in and out, there's ingress and egress. Those laws were passed, and they might have been reaction to the Black Lives Matter protests and the various protests that were going on, but they're certainly going to be applicable when it comes to strikes and labor protests, and we've got a lot in common. And long answer to a short question, I'm sorry, Rick, but I also know in our Constitution within the Teamsters that it's in our Constitution that we believe in treating all races and religions with respect and equality, right, and gender. And that's Teamster gospel that our forefathers within the Teamsters thought was important to put into our Constitution. And I damn sure I'm going to stick up for it. Pardon my expression.
Yeah. No,
darn
sure
I'm going to stick up for it in the general public as well.
And one of the first unions to actually do that. And it's one of the reasons I love this union. But, you know, again, you come back to where we are, especially because I've had, you know, brother Teamsters send me pictures of police, you know, beating up protesters. And I've said the same thing. I go, look, I've been on picket lines. I know they get heated. Are you okay with them coming with those sticks and with those rubber bullets and that pepper spray and the tear gas if you ever have to cross that threshold and walk that picket line? And quickly the tune changes, because when it becomes themselves, then they kind of backpedal a little bit, which is why I think in this moment, kind of throwing that up is kind of important.
Absolutely. I mean, it's hypocritical otherwise, right? I mean, and that's the hypocrisy that's going on within the sorry about that.
Yeah.
But yeah, when the shoe is on the other foot, and to your point, when you use the example of, hey brother, if you were on strike, if you were on strike to save your pension or to save your health care, or to you know, get a first contract, and the police came out and they were heavy handed, right, and arrested you when all you were doing was trying to, you know, make a point and take a stand for your family, you know, you would object to that. And those are the types of conversations that I'm not afraid to have with some of our members that I think on this particular issue are off base.
No, and that's important, because, you know, the question that I then come up with is, you know, how can labor as a whole, how can unions as a whole counter disinformation and anti-democratic narratives that we're being fed every day?
And I'm sorry, I lost you at the beginning of what you were saying.
How can labor, you know, counter some of the disinformation that's out there and the anti-democratic, heavy-handed narratives that we see, especially like around the rallies over the weekend?
We've got little by little and one by one, if that's how we have to do it. We've got to educate our members. We've got to make them aware of some of the legislation that's being passed in some of the state houses on the federal level. I think to not do that is completely irresponsible. I think every international union, local union, and district or joint council, depending on which union you're in, needs to have an aggressive and active role in doing that. I think, I'll tell you a good, earlier in the weekend, a very, very staunch supporter of Mr. Trump, who's a member of ours, and he's a good member, posted and used some expletives about Mr. Trump, and he realized that he's anti-union and so on and so forth, and he posted online, you know, hey, I'm a Teamster for life, you know, and expletive him. Little by little and one by one, you know, there some of the overreach that's gone on, as we talk about, you know, public employees being negatively affected and their bargaining rights, the NLRB, OSHA, DEI programs, those all affect in real life, you know, workers in the United States, and have those agencies are put in place to protect workers, right? You know, when it comes to safety. And I brought this up with one of the folks I was talking with on Saturday. You know, this whole rhetoric about Trump bringing work back to the United States, maybe, let's devil's advocate, maybe he does want to do that. But he does, if he does, he wants it to be done with a watered down NLRB, if there's an NLRB at all, right? With a watered down OSHA, if there's an OSHA there at all, getting rid of DEI programs. And essentially, if there is work that comes back, folks are not going to be able to utilize those, you know, the framework that has, you know, given us the ability to make jobs in America good jobs.
Yeah.
That's really the goal.
And you know, gutting child labor laws and you know, all of that stuff. In fact, you know, being from South Florida, where you're at, the fact that the heat standard that the Biden administration was trying to move forward is now being crushed, that can't be good for your members.
Not at all. No, not at all. In fact, you know, it both the federal level and then at the state level, the state, I believe it was the year before this past legislative session, because our mayor here in Miami-Dade County tried to get some heat legislation put in, pro-worker heat legislation, mandatory breaks, access to water, access to shade, so on and so forth. And that got killed at the state level. So wherever, you know, the pro-business folks were, the pro-business politicians, you know, when it's convenient for them, they believe in home rule, right? But if they don't control, where that legislation comes out of, then they do the reach and say, okay, well, now you can't pass that anymore in your state. You can't pass any heat protection bills. You can't pass living wage ordinances anymore in the state of Florida. That was one of their moves last year as well. In fact, they went on further to say that living wage ordinances that are in existence will sunset, or in other words, will be eliminated, as you know, and I believe it's in 2027. And that's going to be a real problem. And that we do have a lot of members that are affected by that, and they're covered by that. And, you know, let's make no bones about it. You're covered by a living wage ordinance, but you're still the working poor.
Yeah. No, absolutely. But, you know, what's interesting to me in the conversations I've had with people is they're shocked to realize that in a lot of states, you don't have the right to go to the bathroom. You don't have the right to a lunch break. You don't have a right to a break. You have no rights legally. You are the property of that employer while you're on the clock. And most people that I've come across don't seem to want to understand or believe until you lay it out for them. And they're like, oh, I didn't realize.
Yep.
That to me, I think is an education process that needs to be had.
Without question. And, you know, again, one by one and little by little, if that's how it has to be done. But I do believe that, you know, the constant education process, constant information, right? Sharing this information and how it affects our members, how it affects folks that are going to work every day. You mentioned child labor laws. It's almost like bizarro land that we're even talking about watering down child labor laws. You know, kids are supposed to be going to school, right? Kids are supposed to, you know, be going to Little League and to ballet and things like that. Let's let them enjoy their childhood, because the cruel world that exists when you join, you know, the workforce, that's going to be there for a number of years.
Yeah.
It's really going backwards.
But they got such little hands. They can do delicate work.
I couldn't believe that we saw that introduced in the Florida legislature this past session. And luckily it got killed. The legislation was killed in committee. But the more those types of bad ideas get churned around over and over, it resonates with a certain radical faction of the far right, and certainly there's problems with folks on the far left as well, and some of their ideologies, but not when it comes to workers.
Yeah.
We not only have to constantly educate our members and make them aware of these issues, but we also need to partner with like-minded organizations in the general public that want to see, you know, a fair and level playing field in the workplace, collective bargaining rights, equality for all folks of all colors, of all religions. Like I say, it's in our Constitution. as a union. And it's something I was brought up to believe in, and I was proud to be out there on Saturday. I really was, myself and my wife.
It was a great turnout, and the hope is moving forward, you pick up the ball, we run forward, and we continue to organize around the horrible stuff that's happening so we can make a better tomorrow. But, Josh, I appreciate you sharing some thoughts. Good on you for being out on Saturday, and I look forward to talking to you again real soon.
Absolutely, Rick. Thanks for having me on.
Anytime. Josh Zilovich, president and principal officer of the Teamsters Local 769. Check out their website, teamsterslocal769.org. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Did you get out? You going to be ready for the next one? I want to hear it. rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1972. That was the day that 9 firefighters gave their lives in the line of duty in Boston, Massachusetts. The tragedy occurred at the historic Hotel Vendome. Built 100 years earlier, the hotel stood in Boston's Back Bay, one of the most historic neighborhoods in the city. The building was undergoing renovations and being converted into condominiums. A small cafe was open on the first floor, but the rest of the building stood empty due to the construction. On that fateful afternoon, workers noticed smoke. They sounded the alarm, and 100 firefighters rushed to the scene. Within 2 hours, the fire was contained. 3 engines remained for cleanup. Then, without warning, a portion of the building collapsed. 17 firefighters were trapped beneath 2 stories of debris. 9 firemen were killed, leaving behind 8 widows and 23 children. No cause of the fire was ever determined. But it was found that the reason for the collapse was that a support column had been weakened during the renovation. 25 years later, a memorial to these heroes was unveiled, remembering the greatest loss of life in the history of the Boston Fire Department. In 2002, Bruce Springsteen released the song Into the Fire in honor of the firemen who gave their lives on 9/11. It's a song that stands tribute to those whose daily work is running towards danger, not away from it.
Dark sea, healing like you be. You lay your hand on me, walk into the darkness of your smoky grave.
Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So here's a shocker. The Trump administration has instructed ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, to pause raids at agricultural sites, hotels, and restaurants. Who knew it would be bad for the image to go chasing people through the fields, people who showed up and tried to go to work so that you could put food on your table? Who thought that was gonna play badly? Who thought it was gonna play badly to go into meat packing plants and get rid of half the workforce who went through your E-Verify system? Who thought that would be bad? Now, you've got industry groups who are not thrilled. Employers, the moneyed interest, not happy that they're losing their exploitable labor. And look, you've also got unions who have been pushing back. Unions have been active in protesting and documenting these raids. They've offered legal support, negotiation protections for undocumented workers. They've been stepping up. But ICE, you know, they're gonna continue and ramp up their efforts in other sectors. You know, going to keep the moneyed interest happy, but we need the evening news to have, you know, chasing people around. Also, federal judge in Maryland approved nearly $400 million to settle an antitrust wage-fixing case with the poultry industry and poultry processing workers. They say major companies, including Purdue Farms and Tyson Foods, were accused of conspiring to suppress wages, and they have been doing that supposedly for years. The settlement, they say, is a significant win for workers in an industry known for basically stiffing their workers and horrible conditions. Again, another reason another reason why these should be union jobs, like they once were. Again, we're just reliving history as we go. And finally, prediction time. I saw the story of the resignation of two of America's most powerful labor leaders from the Democratic National Committee. I see this as more than just a little political drama. This is a warning shot. With Randy Weingarten of the American Federation of Teachers and Lee Saunders of the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees walking away from the DNC, I got to tell you, I think Ken Martin's days at the DNC as chair are probably numbered. And from a working class perspective, that's a problem. Weingarten and Sanders didn't just quit. They issued pointed criticisms of Martin's failure to grow the party and represent labor voices. Now, understand, these aren't fringe figures. They lead substantial unions who represent over 3 million educators, public workers, frontline, you know, the heroes across the country. And their decision to leave signals a true collapse of trust between the DNC and the labor movement, I think. Now, I had someone go to me, well, you think Sean O'Brien's smiling about this? No, I don't think that's what this is. What Randy Weingarten and Lee Saunders are not saying is that the Republicans are the answer. Now, for working people, this is troubling. When unions lose influence inside the Democratic Party, our wages, our health care, our safety, our collective bargaining, our issues get sidelined. The DNC under Martin seems, again, to be drifting in that direction toward the elite, the consultant class. You know, those folks who shut out the voices of teachers and nurses and sanitation workers and bus drivers. The same people who mobilize voters, knock on doors and power campaigns, sadly are being cut out of the room, out of the hall of power. And understand, if the Democratic Party abandons labor, it risks losing a really reliable base of support. Just when the threat of another Trump term looms, understand they're talking about a third term. Weingarten and Saunders, who backed, you know, a different guy, they backed Ben Wickler, who his theory was, you know, booted in grassroots powder, or is what they say. Now their exit is troubling, and it can be viewed as a protest against what we've seen coming out of Ken Martin. And he may survive. Look, he may survive a few more weeks, but I see his authority crumbling. And unless the DNC starts listening to working people again, it won't be just working people labor leaders walking away. It's going to be the working class who stays home on election day. And that's a disaster. I got to tell you, we can't afford. Now, I had some people go, well, good, you know, Weingarten and Saunders left. Maybe there's a Labor Party. No, the Labor Party is the Democratic Party. And that's where members, you, me, need to be hammering on the Democrats and the DNC to get their heads out of their you-know-whats and actually back and support the folks who brought them to the dance. Understand, the reason they've been getting beaten these last several years, last couple of decades, it's got a lot to do with the fact that they're cozying up to the corporate interest. A lot to do with well, which side they're on. And understand, you know, you've got working people who are supporting Republicans who have been horrible for working people because they just don't trust, they don't believe the Democrats right now. And like I've always said, you know, a drowning man's going to grab an anchor, which is why working people are looking towards the Republicans. Democrats, get your heads out of your behind. Just my thought. Want to hear yours? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Do you think Ken Martin's going to stay around very long? Or do you think we go through a whole term? I want to hear your thoughts. rick@therickSmithShow.com. Miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast. And as always, Thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You're listening to Bull Falls Radio.
WXCO 1230 AM, W255 DN Wausau.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Christopher Cruz in Washington. CBS News has learned administration officials are at odds over whether the U.S. should get directly involved in Israel's war with Iran.
President Trump's abrupt departure from the G7 summit in Canada and a meeting in the Situation Room with some of his closest advisors indicate the president is considering joining Israel in targeting Iran's nuclear sites. Some of the top military brass and Middle East envoy Steve Witkoff were among those who emerged from the Situation Room after roughly an hour in 20 minutes, but reports indicated they were not in full agreement. Prior to the meeting, the president made several social media posts, including one that urged Iranians to, quote, immediately evacuate Tehran. Linda Kenyon, CBS News, the White House.
Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem was taken to a hospital in Washington today. A DHS official said Noem had an allergic reaction and is alert.